What's going on, ladies and gentlemen? Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. If you are new here, Polititeen is a podcast that hopes to spark political conversation in our youth by talking about current politics with people that are currently politically active. With that being said, thank you for tuning in to today's episode, and as always, happy listening.
All right, so one of the main disclaimers that we have for today's podcast is the fact that our audio has a certain echo to it in the middle of the first segment with Dr. Lester, our first interview. So we're working steadily to resolve this issue, and once we do resolve it, we will contact each and every one of you via email or via our Twitter to make sure that you guys know that the audio is updated. But you know, for now, I think you can hear us pretty perfectly. I think the echo should be a nuisance for the first couple of minutes, but once you get past it, it should be okay. But if you have any questions or concerns with the podcast, always make sure to contact our email or Twitter. And thank you so much for bearing with our difficulties.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Polititeen. As always, I'm joined by Varun.
Hey, guys. My name is Varun. I'm a co-host of the Polititeen podcast, where we try to have political discussions every single episode and to spark political conversation within today's youth. Now, today with us, we have a very special guest, Dr. Lester, who is the director of the Project Humanities Program at Arizona State University, and a person that I've looked up to for his efforts in ensuring racial equity and equality across America. So, Dr. Lester, if you'd like to introduce yourself for our guests.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me and for an important conversation. I'm a professor of English here at Arizona State University. July marks my 23rd year here. I teach American literature and culture, which the umbrella of American race relations falls under. I do American pop culture. And before coming to Arizona State University, I was a faculty member at the University of Alabama in Tuscaloosa.
Awesome. And that's, you know, a great wealth of experience for us to kind of draw off of for our podcast here today. Now, my first question to you, which kind of spins off what we ask all of our guests when they jump on our podcast, growing up in the peak of the civil rights era and having to actually, you know, go through the process of integrating within an all-white elementary school, obviously you've had plenty of reasons to speak out against discrimination in today's world and to continue to promote equity for all. But if you had to pick one reason for why you chose to enter this field, and moreover, to start the Project Humanities program, what would it be?
Well, that's interesting because I don't know that it was a conscious choice. I think I was thrust into it and responded even when I wasn't aware that I was responding. And what I mean by that is being integrated when I was probably in the fifth grade, didn't really have any say-so in that. I was certainly thrust into conversations about race that I couldn't even understand until much later as an adult and reflecting on that. I don't know that it's always a conscious choice. Sometimes the circumstances sort of force us into that. Did become a conscious choice was studying African American literature as a graduate student in the early 80s. And at a time when I majored in American literature, I wanted my focus specifically to be on African American literature because I saw that nobody else was sort of looking at that, and it was sort of an afterthought when it came to talking about Faulkner and Hemingway and Washington Irving and those people. So my more consciously activist action, I think, came in through the teaching. So again, I wasn't asked to do the activist stuff, but it became part of my acknowledging my own identity, but also recognizing that there was so much I felt like I could contribute to the world in addition to what was already going on. So I don't remember having a moment of clarity early on because I didn't know what I was experiencing and didn't have a language for it. And nobody in my family actually talked about it.
I think that it's very interesting, Dr. Lester, how you kind of explained that you were thrust into it. And it's a very far conclusion to draw here, but in a lot of sense, you know, early slaves being brought to America, they didn't have any say-so in what they were doing. And that kind of goes into how their own culture was drawn, and it's very unique in the sense that, you know, they have no African American history. Doesn't start with African history. It starts when they were brought over here because they were stripped of their own history. And I think that that's very interesting that you go on to teach a lot about this. And if you want to talk a little bit about those teachings, feel free.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting that I did have a choice, as I explained, to teach African-American literature at the University of Alabama because I saw that people weren't doing it. So nobody at the time was teaching Leroy Jones or Amir Baraka or Lorraine Hansberry. And I noticed this as I finished my graduate degree and was doing my dissertation. I chose to write on a Black female playwright, and precisely because her play was relegated to the end of a semester, people were rushed. It was a play that I struggled with, trying to understand and force it into a model of the perfect play, which is a European Western construct. So there are all these ways in which that was sort of a conscious kind of thinking about my identity, but thinking at it in it as a way that was not separate from what I was studying. I certainly had lots and lots of brushes with racism prior to that. I was also naive enough to think that, you know, I was working hard and was being rewarded for the work that I was doing and not really looking at the nuances. I say this sort of interestingly, fondly, but also regrettably, as I graduated as valedictorian of my Georgia college, that's now a university, with an English degree, one of the few, if not the only, Black students in the English department. And I probably left with knowledge of having studied two Black poets that whole four-year career. That's astonishing because it speaks to the ways in which education has also been complicit in supporting systemic racism. And that is all sort of coming to bear now in this, what many have called this sort of reckoning moment with American racism. So even as I was sort of trying to live and do what I thought was important and engaging and interesting, that in and of itself, choosing to focus on these Black writers became a statement, not a statement that was necessarily meant to be high charged and political. But I certainly recognize that now as I go into my classrooms, I choose what's on my syllabus, and I choose to take these texts in a direction that I hope sheds light on how we live our lives today.
Yeah, it's extremely admirable how you really focused upon Black culture in teaching and in learning. And I guess I wanted to ask you about, you know, you talked about an article published by ASU, the fact that a lot of students, notably those at the University of Edinburgh, are comfortable saying the N-word because this isn't their history. And so they don't have the same connection. Well, I think that I can speak for Damien in saying this, that the problem lies in the fact that our regular history courses are, I guess, so whitewashed that many people have been oblivious to the truth of how imperfect America is, especially for racial minorities in our country. So what is your perspective on how history is taught in America and how we can teach lessons in secondary and post-secondary institutes that promote tolerance and equality for all?
Okay. First of all, history is not just something that comes out of a book, and history is not something that comes out of a classroom. I think history is the culture. History is the music. History is what you watch and not see on television. I remember growing up as a kid, and we would have 50s Day at our elementary school, but I never knew what Black people looked like 50s Day, because there were no Black people on Happy Days, and there were no Black people on the Brady Bunch. So there are ways in which the history, you know, I start some of my classes off with this African proverb that says, hunters cease to be heroes when lions tell their stories. So I think that's what this is about. It's the way in which we first of all recognize that there is no single history. There are intersecting histories, and it depends on those who are in power to tell those stories and control those narratives. And even now, these narratives are butting into each other such that we are actually seeing that there is a kind of dismantling of a narrative that we've all been fed. And it's not just our history classes, it's the whole education system. I was just talking about this relative to, you know, my work as a scholar, as an African-American scholar who studies African-American literature, the way in which the academy has been complicit in creating these hierarchies of value these hierarchies of what constitutes research, what constitutes excellence. All of these things have been informed by this sort of political, cultural bias against those who have been minoritized. And we can also throw women into that as well. And then when we start looking at things intersectionally, you know that, you know, third women of color are still not represented to the extent that white women are. Who is the equivalent of Jane Austen? Who is the equivalent of, you know, we can ask any number of things. I also think that is what I've tried to sort of use popular culture for, because there's a poster that I have that says before Marilyn and Madonna was Josephine Baker. So the question is, why isn't Josephine Baker important enough to talk about when Madonna and Marilyn Monroe aren't doing anything significantly different she was? Or, you know, and part of this is that we discover this as we evolve. So we are still learning things about history. You know, I'm learning things now as I do my work. You mentioned the N-word. I'm learning there are even more of these Disney tunes that are actually minstrel songs. And once you sort of know that, then you can't unknow that. So I don't know that it's a matter of, you know, let's look back and see why we haven't. I think the question, more importantly for me, is are we doing it now? And are we willing to open ourselves to evolving and changing, even how we see it now, as we start to learn more, and as we start to listen more, and as we start to uncover more?
Dr. Lester, I'm going to be completely honest with you. I have hundreds of thousands of questions to ask you right now. I think that what you're saying fits perfectly with the whole message of the podcast, especially the last little segment there with listening and talking and hearing each other more. And that kind of relates me back, this whole thing that you were talking about kind of relates me back to a conversation that we were having with Natalie Busco. I asked her, what is one thing that you wish that was talked about more, one thing that you think deserves more attention? And she kind of brought up this notion that the school rules are even racist and discriminate against. And it's something that, you know, me and Varun, we had no clue on, and we learn and we try to live in this world of political activism and trying to learn every day. And it's crazy how we can learn more and more things. So what she had said was that, you know, the dress code being kind of appropriated towards women dressing more conservatively because men can't focus. You know, in Georgia, you have players' braids being cut off or their dreads being cut off because of the fact that they can't graduate because it's a distraction to the class. I mean, there's so many different things that I want to ask you about all of these subjects. But what are your thoughts on school rules and how? I mean, it's just blind discrimination that is so hard to see. But once you see it, like you said, it can be unseen.
Well, it's not hard for those who are most affected by it to see. What it highlights is the privilege of those who don't have to see. So if it's not about you, and that's you rhetorically, then it's not really a reason. And I think that's what this is about, this moment that we're in now, is the extent to which capacity to have more empathy. It doesn't have to be you, but to care enough about humanity, which is what these oppressions deny, then that's what the sort of dismantling the system. The problem is that there's so many things that feed into this because it has a certain serviceability. It wouldn't be in place if it didn't service someone. Those for whom this benefits are not going to give this up very easily. So if people have benefited systems of privilege, one can't come in and just say, okay, let's flip that light off and we're going to change things. Because that's not how systems work. People have benefited from systems. Talking about this, and I'm coming to understand this, you know, after all these years, which is why I think, you know, I like to think of myself as a lifelong learner. This is not stuff that I knew when I started this work. This is stuff that I've learned as we've, you know, muddled through this pandemic, as we've watched these this crisis sort of come to a head in protest. And I started looking at all of the pieces that speak to how capitalism is in fact at the root of all of these isms and all of these oppressions, because people benefit from them. The people who benefit from them are not going to give them up easily. So while we are changing everything from, you know, Aunt Jemima and Uncle Ben, those things matter. We're making statements about aligning oneself to racial justice and against racial injustice. Still needs to be someone giving up resources. What that means is that we have to look at what the leadership looks like, the wages look like. We have to look at how decisions are made and policies are created. So I don't know that the public schools or any schools are any different from the universities that I spoke of earlier with this hierarchy of what values, you know, who's teaching in the classroom, what are the evaluations looking like for faculty of color, you know, what is tenure promotion looking like. But I also ask that relative to, you know, the conversations we're having about policing. Well, I think what's overwhelming is the fact that there are so many networks that are forming the roots of this thing we're now talking about is systemic racism. So one of the reasons that you don't know about that is because you didn't have to know about it, in the same way that I don't have to know about menstrual equity, because those are not products that I use. I can also care about, because I have those in my family who do use menstrual hygiene products. And so even those kinds of things should lead us more toward looking at the ways in which we are being complicit if we are not somehow taking action against. And we can't just say things like, well, you don't know what you don't know, because there has to be a way for us to start seeking to know, not just being comfortable and not knowing.
Yeah, and you know, myself and Damien, we talk about it on almost every episode. Whether it's global warming or racial injustice or anything else politically kind of related, it's so easy to shut a blind eye. You know, and we talked about this one quote, silence is complicity. And it's more true now than ever. And I guess I wanted to ask you, based upon the system that you're talking about, a flawed system in America, you did some research trying to dig up places where discrimination can lie within personal ads, and I've seen a lot of it firsthand. You know, when I read your article on how discrimination can lie in personal ads, I thought of Indian ads, wherein they feature light-skinned actors instead of more dark-skinned actors because they think that looks better for people to look at. And talk about
how white people to look at, because that's the first audience, and then the second audience are those who have internalized whiteness as an idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that you talk about how personal ads give people a place where they can hide behind a sort of anonymity, and how these people aren't held accountable if their ads are deemed inappropriate. So on the topic of accountability, I wanted to ask you, kind of verging on a different point when we talked about policing, if you could compare why the makers of these ads feel so comfortable in being discriminatory to why police officers are so comfortable in pulling the trigger, considering that qualified immunity is bound to shift their accountability away from them.
Right. Well, again, there are reasons that policing has been in place for as long as it has, because it serves certain people in ways that it doesn't serve others. And we see that in examples of Amy Cooper and Susan Smith and in the number of white people who have weaponized police. We saw her, you know, in Central Park, you know, nearly strangling her dog because she had to somehow feign fear of a black man. That's a trope that is as you know, as ancient as Reconstruction. That's why we would have lynchings. And these lynchings were largely there were no consequences for those who did it. In fact, as you know from having looked at the history of lynching, and other kinds of racial terrorism domestically, is that, you know, that was the law, the vigilante law, and it was primarily these young black men. So for me, there is a clear connection between the ways in which black and brown bodies are policed and tragically killed, because it perpetuates this system, benefits some and not others. So yes, in fact, the accountability is an issue. I see police who are, you know, fighting to hold these student resource officers on campus, for example, even in the face of all the data that shows black and brown students are more likely to be introduced to the juvenile justice system much earlier than their white counterparts. Black and brown students are more suspended and expelled for the same behavior. And we also recognize that most of the teachers are still probably about 80% white and female. And there's clearly a racial cultural bias there. The ways in which we adultify Black kids in ways that we don't white kids, Tamir Rice, for example. So there are all kinds of ways in which there's no, this is really messy. And nobody's asking one group to solve it. We're just asking people to look at all these different parts to sort of figure out how have you participated in this? How have you complicit in this? And what exactly can you do to disrupt this? Again, it goes back to redistribution of resources, taking away in meaningful ways, you know, what gives power. And in this case, resources give you power and authority. So, you know, I look at these $1 million budgets that police departments have, and you put that up against, you know, the lives that have been lost. And you start asking, well, what is it about this system that isn't working? We'd be imaginative enough sort of figure out some alternatives to this. I think that's where we have fallen short with the empathy. That's where we fall short with some of what was being referenced earlier about, I didn't know this. Well, now that you know, what are you going to do about it? Because we have to move from awareness to action. We have to move from non-racist to anti-racist. And I think all of these things connect. Again, that's what's overwhelming about it, but that's also what's exciting about it, because we can't just imagine if we fix it here, we don't have to address it here. So it's not a matter of, and I'll use this metaphor, of patching up the roof because there's a leak. We have to replace the whole roof. Yeah. There has to be a new one.
Yeah, and I think a powerful statement that you said is resources are power. And I have always argued, and the reason that we start this podcast is because I think that the strongest resource is knowledge. And I think that you know, in being a Hispanic male, a point that you were bringing up, and that I had been completely blind to, even as a subject of it, is the fact that I don't think I've ever had a teacher that's Hispanic or that represents me. And all my role models, in the sense of teachers and of educators, have always been white men. And it's very interesting now, and you're giving me a completely different perspective on something that I've never even seen. So my question to you is, how can we create this conversation as we're trying to do here on Politeam? How can we get people to want to seek this knowledge and to have the uncomfortable conversation in America?
Well, that's a toughie, because nobody wants to be uncomfortable, but I don't know if that's different from any kind of discovery that happens in a classroom. I introduce lots of texts that some people would think were shocking. In my Project Humanities initiative, we talk about things that people don't often talk about. For example, this past weekend, we had a podcast discussion. We don't create a podcast, but we create discussions around a select podcast. So this podcast was typically about police kits that have been thrown away, rape kits. That's an uncomfortable conversation to have, and some who had been sexually violated were triggered by that. People left who did join in left with this sort of new understanding of, first of all, the extent to which society doesn't value women and those who are raped, because it's not just women, or those who are violated. But also, money isn't invested into figuring out what to do to make sure that these rape kits are tested in a timely way, and that they're not sort of tossed out because you don't have space. Those are hard conversations to have. Conversations about menstrual equity, why it should matter to those who don't necessarily menstruate. Those are conversations that people aren't necessarily having, and I think I want to believe, perhaps naively, that when people learn, they know more, or they're likely to sort of behave differently. But I don't know that that's necessarily the case, because, and I'm you know, the whole knowledge is power thing, I want to challenge that a little bit, because I left my undergraduate school, I felt very knowledgeable, knew what I had been exposed to. And when I was sort of challenged about that knowledge, it sort of rocked me. In the same way that I'll say knowing one set of ideas about systemic oppression doesn't mean that you automatically know another. So even in this conversation, I pay attention to language. I pay attention to, you know, how we talk about race, how we talk about gender, to some extent how we talk about class. I'm hearing, even in the language that's being used, some ableist language. And, you know, I want to care as much about people who are oppressed by language as those who are oppressed by race and gender. We don't have to do an oppression gymnastics, but I want people to care about what we say, because we can be very passionate about race and not care about sexism.
Yeah.
We can be very passionate about feminism and womanism, not care about race. We can be very passionate about this. I want us to be just as passionate about all of these different ways in which our language reflects how we think, and how we think then can translate to policies and procedures that further discriminate.
Yeah, you know, I think that I agree completely, 1,000%. And I think I speak for Damien in saying that it's the right approach. You know, okay. Damien, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, you know, I listen to what we say, and I hear the sort of the energy and the excitement, and I'm just like overwhelmed in the most positive way, because I want people around me to be passionate about something. I also want to make sure that we call out and call in as we're having these discussions. And trust me, I have been called out and called in. That has made me understand more in those places, because even I cannot see behind me.
Yeah.
And that's where that sort of metaphor privilege comes in. You know, and I think that's one, you know, talking about old people, talking about, you know, discriminating and making fun of people who are different body sizes. All of those we still relegate to jokes, you know, even our ableist language. That is one front that I've been working on for years. When we talk about words matter, and we use words that are often associated with the identities of people who are differently able. So, you know, people will say, you're just being politically correct. And I was like, well, but political correct, first of all, is kind of a dismissal by people who cling to something called identity politics. Usually that's by people who are already in view. They are in the mirror and they see their reflection. Identities come in when people are somehow left out of the picture and they don't see themselves in the mirror, because the mirrors of society don't mirror society.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. I hope that didn't throw you off there.
No, I think that it was exactly what I wanted to hear. Because, you know, myself and Damien, we always talk about how it's important to bring in facts and not necessarily persuade somebody towards something.
Exactly. Right. Well, but I also remember, you know, that's why, you know, there's this whole conversation about science. There's this whole conversation about technology. What's often missing from that is the way in which science and technology have been complicit in perpetuating racist practices also. And I'm thinking of the Syphilis Project. I'm thinking of the ways in which Black bodies were used to experiment on some kind of cancer drug. So there are ways in which science, and even the sort of pseudoscience that told us that Black people were inferior intellectually, and that, you know, IQs were based on all this, and that Black people could be menials but not necessarily have anything to do with the brain. So it is so embedded, as I read in this one piece, that these systems are so calcified that it's hard for people to kind of look at the extent to which we have been complicit. And I say we because I'm part of that we as well, and that's why I say this is very much about learning and unlearning, as it is about, you know, having these conversations. Some of this will happen independent of someone else, but I also want people to be stepping outside of their own comfort zone, talking more to people who don't look like them, and talking more to people who don't think like them, because that's how we really, I think, sort of get at the basis of how do we look at the humanity and then see how that humanity manifests itself structurally and organizationally.
Yeah, no, and there's so many different things that you kind of brought up that kind of like started shooting cylinders in my mind. You talk about identity politics, and I've said on the podcast that's the worst thing that you can probably do is go on a first date and someone asks you, tell me about yourself, and you say I'm Republican or Democrat or something like that. It closes you off to having conversations about the other side. It shows you that you kind of can't look in the mirror and see what's wrong with you. And then that kind of sparked the conversation between our own privilege. And it's so unique how it's interesting, rather, how people have privileges that you can't even see. Me and Varun talked about, you know, our parents being, whether they're together, whether you're in a two-person household, that transcends race, that transcends gender. And I'm blessed enough to to be in a two-person household. So how can I help someone who's not? How can I bring that person onto the level playing field? Now, how can someone who has the knowledge of living in this country for hundreds of years help me and my parents, who have only lived here for one generation, obtain the knowledge of how to do your taxes, of all these different things? It's just you're an extremely insightful guest, and I think that it's creating such a conversation, and it's sparking so many questions in my mind, and I'm really passionate, and I'm really thankful that you're coming on with us.
What's interesting though is I think and this can be overwhelming to folks, which is why I'm very skeptical about all these different lists that are circulating now. There's a list. Read these 10 document or watch these 10 documentaries. Watch this, watch that. I'm excited about that on the one hand, also skeptical about that in the same way that I'm skeptical about all these organizational, institutional statements that are coming out. What I want to do is to see what people are really, really doing, address sort of structural things. So I want us to read a book. I want us to read the right book. If we're gonna read a book about, or if we're going to watch a movie about Black people, and all of our complexities, please don't watch The Help, because that's not going to help you see the complexities of Black identity. In fact, what that will do is sort of perpetuate these stereotypes that Black people have no voices outside of some white lens or white gaze. Don't look at the Green Book. Recognize that these are the ones that mainstream America, white mainstream America, have sort of seen as sort of these great stories about Black people. They are not. So, you know, there are ways in which this has to be looked at in many ways. And the most that I think we can do is to bring a critical lens to this. On the other hand, say, you know, changing some of those policies also fix things too. So stop the policies about hair. About hair being distracting, or which, and you mentioned hair like cornrows and dreadlocks and box braids. Well, you don't have to say Black people typically are identified with. You just have to name those hairstyles. I'm saying even these coded ways of talking about race. Stop telling me, for example, that artificial intelligence is neutral. It is not. Stop pretending that technology doesn't have its own bias. I can see that when I'm trying to do spell check, I'm trying to write something in Black vernacular and it keeps changing it.
Yeah.
See what I'm saying? And yeah. and in the work that I do, I'm often quoting things that are in Black vernacular. And every single time, spell check forces me to go in and accept it and change it. So where does that standard come from? Standard comes from some standard that someone has created that benefits people who only use that kind. And notice again, the spell check tells me if it's wrong. It doesn't say, oh, by the way, is this a dialect? Because the thing that I've typed is not wrong. It's exactly how it is and how it sounds. The spell check doesn't acknowledge that. It's complicated. I'm just pleased and so inspired by the work that you are doing as young people care. You know, there's nothing more. I think I heard poet Maya Angelou say this. There's nothing worse than young people who are cynical and young people who have no passion and don't care. Thank you for countering that. And I mean, caring more about, you know, one thing than the other, the latest Instagram post or the latest TikTok video or that. You may be doing all that, I don't know. But you're also doing this. And it's very encouraging. I've heard people say that there's something about this moment we're experiencing both nationally and internationally that is different because so many young people are involved in it. And I want to believe that, but I also want to believe that there are older people on whose shoulders young people have stood on and who are reading and thinking. I'm still seeing Angela Davis out there. I'm still seeing, you know, all of these civil rights folks who fought, you know, Jesse Jackson and others who fought during the 60s. They are still doing this. And even Merle Evers was on saying, you know, I'm 90 years old. I can't get out on the streets, but I can still raise my voice and protest against injustice. That to me means that the experiences that we're having now are intergenerational. Systemic racism didn't just start now. It didn't just start in the 80s or when, you know, some of the protesters were born. This has persisted for 400 plus years. And the fact that we're trying to dig at the roots is encouraging.
Yeah, you know, we talked about a couple of podcasts ago about how a lot of what MLK and other Black Lives advocates, you know, over 50 years ago said still remains applicable, which goes to say that, you know, we have not made as much progress as we would like to make. And there's a long way to go in ensuring economic and racial equity in America. And it's interesting that you bring up the fact that movies and kind of books are not kind of reflecting Black culture in the way that they should be. And I've always been an advocate of the fact that, you know, movies and books about Black culture have kind of been a Black ice cream cone dipped in white chocolate as a coating. You know, it's written in the way that white people want to portray Black culture and oppose Black culture. You know, Damien and myself talked a couple of podcasts ago about how in history classes, we talk about so much about Martin Luther King, but never about Malcolm X. And arguably, he played on an equal level of a role as MLK. Now, I would love to talk to you about everything that we've been discussing today. I think that I have millions of questions, as Damien does, in my mind. But we're almost over our time limit here. And I guess I wanted to ask a question that we ask our guests every single episode at the very end. If you had one message to a young viewer on our podcast, or even an old viewer for that matter, about what we've said today and your overall stance on these issues, what would it be?
Well, continue to learn and continue to open your eyes. Continue to recognize that there are all kinds of ways that we can participate in this moment that is a movement. There is not a space that you can't inhabit and contribute to. If you're not contributing to it, then you're potentially perpetuating it.
Wow. I think that that's just an absolutely, you know, incredible message to be left on here. And I think me and Varun are definitely going to discuss that as the podcast continues here. But I want to thank you for coming on. With that being said, we're going to cut to a quick commercial break, and me and Varun will be back with some more commentary.
Holy crap, man.
Wow, that was an absolutely incredible conversation. I'm here. We're live again. We're back from the commercial. Man, wow. What can you say about that, Varun?
You know, I jumped on the podcast and I said, holy crap, man. You know, it was insane how much expertise and knowledge he had about not only the Black Lives Matter movement, but how, you know, minorities have been oppressed by technology. He talked about how spell check has been kind of cutting back on what he's been saying, how language influences how society views different classes and different minorities. I think that everything he said opened my mind up to different perspectives about how America is built and the backbone of what systemic racism is, because I think that I have not seen anybody who has looked at it from every single angle. And I think that's what Dr. Lester has done. He's looked at racism and oppression at every single angle and come up with a 360-degree view, and he shared that with us today. It was almost like a lesson for me.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. It felt like an interactive lecture. And it's something that's interesting is, you know, we talked about this. I think I brought it up multiple times, how we've been so blind in ourselves and not seeing our own privilege. And I think that even goes on in a sense, it goes on by only having this discussion. And I love that Dr. Lester brought in conversations about, you know, women and about women being oppressed and about this group being oppressed and that group. And he didn't just leave it to African Americans being oppressed, which is something very easy to do in this time period where we're fighting for Black Lives Matter. And it's incredible how, you know, I look at our podcast and I say, you know, we haven't really had the discussion of females being oppressed, and I haven't really been educated in the subject matter. I think that it's something that's underlooked and oftentimes, and I hope that it's something that we can focus more on the podcast too. And whether it's a conversation with him or other female activists or other male activists that are fighting for female rights, it's just crazy how it's just stuff that we overlook, and it's something that just seems so simple. But yet we're just ignorant to it.
Yeah, I think that on the podcast, we've been kind of riding the wave, if you understand what I'm saying here.
Yeah.
I think that we've been kind of looking at Black Lives Matter and racial justice in America and saying, this is what we should be talking about instead of other issues that are just as important. You know, the Yemen crisis, kids in cages with the ICE, women's rights, sexism, and things like that, rape culture in America. I think that we have let so many issues kind of bypass us. And right now, I think that it's a good point for us to kind of delve away from that in the next couple of episodes and talk more about different issues that may not have been kind of pushed forth on mainstream media, because we are kind of being complicit in not recognizing these issues. You know, we talk so much about silence as complicity, but we are being complicit because we're not talking about women's rights.
Yeah.
We're not talking about sexism. I think that we're part of the issue in this circumstance. But I think society as a whole also tends to ride the wave. And I think that, you know, we have to grow past that and try to tackle every single issue equally. And I think that every single day, each of us should look at our articles and sources from beyond racism and look at what problems America is facing. And, you know, 4th of July was this Saturday. And I think that I was having a discussion with my friends, and we were talking about how it takes a good American to recognize the issues that we're facing and to not shut a blind eye and say that, you know, as Americans, we're beyond those. We're not beyond anything.
Yeah.
I think being a patriot means we have to tackle the issues that we have at hand, whether it means kneeling for the flag. I think that is also tackling the issues that we have at hand and being more of a patriot than somebody who blindly stands up for something they don't believe in.
Yeah, well, to talk on your last subject, the thing that you just brought up, I think that stems in, and that stems in perfectly with Dr. Mason's last message that he left for us, where he says, I'm going to misquote this because I probably have the worst memory on earth, but it's America is my country, or I love America as my country, and therefore I am allowed to criticize it. Or America is my country, and thus I am given the right to criticize it. And that kind of goes to show that the main thing that you can do, I think self-respect transcends loving yourself and taking care of yourself. It's seeing what's wrong with you and trying to fix that. And I think it's great that we're acknowledging that on the podcast. Hey, Varun, what are we doing wrong? What aren't we talking about? How are we being complicit? And it might be uncomfortable. I mean, I feel a little bit uncomfortable that we're kind of canceling ourselves. We're saying, hey, why aren't we talking about this? But we need to do that. And we need to say, hey, me and you, Varun, while we may not be doing it on purpose, we're doing it. So how can we try to help? We're never going to be perfect. We're never going to be 1,000% perfect. We're never going to be able to talk about every single issue. But how can we try to generalize and try to bring everyone, uplift everyone, give a voice to as many people as we can? And I hope that that's something that we can really do on Polititeen. But on a latter point that you were talking about, you said that you kind of want to stem away from the racial thing. I don't want to stem away from it in later episodes. What I want to do, as a matter of fact, is that I want to bring other things in. And yeah. I think that that's what riding a wave is supposed to be. It's not supposed to just be riding the hill of the wave. It's supposed to be turning around and seeing what's coming, you know? What's coming behind that? And we need to bring all this stuff. We need to bring women's issues. We need to bring Hispanic issues. We need to bring African-American women's issues, lesbian issues, gay issues. We need to bring all these issues and help each other ride the wave, as opposed to just focusing on one thing. And I think that that's what we need to do. And I think that unfortunately, we haven't been doing that as much. I know that we talk about a dozen things here on the podcast. We talk about LGBTQ rights, but it's about how we can talk about more and how we can do more and how we are, you know, I love throwing around the word ignorant. And I think that a lot of people in America are ignorant, but that doesn't exclude me. That I am ignorant to a lot of issues, and I am ignorant. I can say, you know, in the past, I've been ignorant to the use of the N-word, and I've been ignorant to the use to the transgender community and ignorance in the sense that I have not been knowledgeable towards the subject. And I think that we need to just create conversation about everything.
Yeah, you know, I think that, you know, with you talking about how patriotism stems from recognizing the issues that we're facing and trying to fix them, I wanted to kind of make an analogy to something that I find more kind of accurate and comfortable for viewers today, young kids, young voters. You know, if you were talking to a friend who you barely know, a new acquaintance, you wouldn't kind of point out his flaws. You'd be like giving him compliments to kind of get to know him better. But if you know somebody well enough to where you love them, like your mother or your girlfriend or one of your best friends, you would not be afraid to tell them what's wrong with them and to tackle their flaws with them.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, us being patriots, we love our country more than being acquaintances with it. We know our country, we love our country, and we're committed to making it the best country that we can live in, because, you know, we are American citizens. But upon your previous point about how we've grown, and we have grown from people who have, you know, been ignorant to saying the N-word in some circumstances, myself included, and ignorant about many, many things, I think that I wanted to address this with Dr. Lester before our time ended, but I was kind of cut short, and I want to address it with you. How do you feel about cancel culture in America? Because a lot of people...
you just read my mind. I was about to bring that up.
Yeah, man. You know, a lot of people commit acts of cancel culture when they see people kind of shifting from the original circumstances and saying that, you know, you did this, so you're always going to be tied back by this. So how do you feel about that?
Well, I think that the issue is that tying back. We need to stop tying back. We need to look back, acknowledge, say, hey, what's your statement on this? What are your looks on this? How have you grown? Who are you today? And look at that as opposed to what we've done in the past. I myself have done very ignorant things in the past, but I'm not the person that I was 10 years ago. Especially, you know, I would have been 6, so that's to exclude. But I'm not the person that I was a year ago. I'm not the person that I was 2 years ago. I'm not the person that I was 3 months ago, 2 weeks ago. You know, before we started the podcast, I don't even think I'm the same person there. I've gained so much knowledge onto issues that I wouldn't have spoken out about otherwise. I think most Americans can say that they've said the N-word, that they've used the N-word. No matter how you use it. You know, you just have to be able to say that, and I have to say, yeah, I used it wrong, but I'm learning now how my actions have consequences, and it's important to say that I'm not the person that I was before, and that's something that we need to all grow in. We need to be able to call ourselves out like I just did then. It's important. It's important that we just don't cancel people and say, hey, you know, Like, for example, if I were to be canceled for the statement that I just made, that wouldn't make sense, because right now I'm trying to have a conversation on why it is bad, and I'm not the same person that I was before. So if you have someone doing blackface, but now they're an activist against blackface, how are you going to tell them that they're a horrible person? They've obviously grown and learned from that situation.
Yeah, I think that, you know, people know that if you did blackface and you became Black Lives Matter activist, I mean, you know you were a horrible person in your past. You don't have to have somebody coming up to you 24/7 and saying, you know, Varun, you were a bad person in your past. I think that the reason why you transformed from that stance to what you are right now is because you understood that you were a bad person in the past and you've come to terms with that.
Yeah.
I think it's beyond saying that, you know, you understand that.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And it's about just knowing the fact, hey, I screwed up, and we're all human. We all mess up. Some slip ups are bigger than others. And that's why I'm a big activist. You know, we had the pure hatred episode here, and I just don't want expulsion for those racist acts. What I want is true acknowledgement of those acts and say, hey, you know, I messed up. How can I grow as a person? And I think that that's just the most important thing. How can we grow? How can we grow? And I think that we need to call each other out, but we need to be constructive in the sense that we do it. I don't think that we need to just stop, you know. Again, we talked about it on the statue episode with Will Carroll, where it's not, we don't need to tear down the statues. We need to have a footnote on the bottom of that statue.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to be an activist for Black Rights Matter, I've never done anything racist or anything. I definitely have never used the N-word in a derogatory manner. You know, there needs to be a footnote that says, why did I become an activist for Black Lives Matter? And my answer would be, you know, I've had Black friends, and I've had Black brothers and sisters, and I myself, being Hispanic, have faced discrimination. Therefore, I have decided to join this movement. And someone else's answer to that question might be, I was a part of the KKK, and I saw the most disgusting and most inhumane characterizations of African Americans, and I've decided that I cannot stand for that. I cannot live with being that person. So therefore, I have decided to completely flip sides. Are we going to criticize that person and tell them that, no, you can't be in Black Lives Matter, you were part of the KKK?
So where do they go?
Yeah.
You know, they can't join the movement that they've left behind, you know, their hood from the KKK to join. Where do they go? You know, I think that it raises the question of, if we're kicking people out because of their past actions, are we gonna let them be their past selves? I think a lot of people, if they're kicked out of these kind of BLM groups because of their past, they're just gonna go back to being that kind of person.
Yeah.
And I think that we need to dissuade people from being that kind of person, and half of that starts with accepting them and accepting their flaws, because, you know, inevitably they've accepted their flaws in joining such a movement. They've accepted who they were in the past. And we need to understand that it's hard for them. It's very, very hard for somebody to go from being a very discriminatory person to being a person who accepts all people. And I guess I wanted to mention, upon your previous point, I'm forgetting here my line of thought.
Don't worry about it.
Actually, go ahead. Yeah, I'm gonna remember my.
No, line. Don't worry about it. That happens to me. That happens to me all the time. I'm forgetting what the hell I was about to talk about. But no, I mean, it's just. in a sense, and you have to look at it like this. The reason that we have such African-American discrimination, such black discrimination, is because they were left behind, right? African-Americans, Hispanics, we were left behind. We, not they, not pointing fingers, we were left behind. Americans have been left behind. That's why I talk about not leaving the coal miners behind. So if you go to an, if you enter this area of wokeness, as it's been called on social media, if you are woke and you start considering being woke in elitist group, aren't you just doing the same thing that slave masters did? Aren't you just doing the same thing that slave owners did? And in the sense that you're saying, oh, you can't be up here with me because you are less than because of this, because of the color of your skin. Now, what you're saying is you can't be in Black Lives Matter because of your old way of thought, your old train of thought, your old beliefs. So no, you cannot be this elitist group that I am a part of. And you're doing the same thing if you're just leaving them behind. You need to bring them along and you need to give them a hug and say, thank you for changing. Thank you for trying to make the change. Let me show you what we have to offer. You can show me what you have to offer. How can we help each other out here in this movement? You know, it's such just, we can't leave people behind. We need to stop trying to leave people behind. And I hate that woke culture is becoming this elitist thing where it's like you have to be the most, you literally almost have to be God to be in woke culture. And I bet they would cancel God. You know what I'm saying?
They would. They find it's almost like politics. You know, you're going to find one bad thing about a person that makes him. You know, yeah. You're going to find one piece of dirt about a candidate that makes him. And it goes both ways. I've never seen a single candidate who's been perfect. You know, if Jesus ran for president, he would have got some kind of dirt thrown on him by the opposing party. You know, you can't make a perfect person or a perfect ideal. I think that we all have to accept that there was some point wherein any of us did something insensitive, whether it was in our childhood or our adulthood. I think that none of us are perfect, and we all have to accept that the American people are people that have made mistakes, and that I think that the most beautiful thing that I've seen in the American people is our resolve, our determination to change and to become better. Because how many war crimes has our country committed? Are we going to cancel our country? You know, if you can cancel a person for doing something, can you cancel the United States of America?
Yeah, no, and you know, it's just such an interesting point. The fact that we're just canceling, and I'm in an odd situation because I love, as you know, I love making jokes. And I feel like the jokes that I make, they could be, now I'm not talking about like making like Jim Crow jokes and like putting on blackface and dancing and on top of a table in a classroom. That's not what I'm talking about as a joke. I'm talking about like small insensitive remarks. I feel like people should be free to, I feel like the way to move forward is to laugh about, do you get what I'm saying? I'm having a difficulty wording it, but if you are going to be stone-faced on everything, if someone's going to make fun of you for who you are and you're not willing to accept that and you're going to get all defensive about it, then you have a security, an insecurity about who you are. I think that we need to be, as Americans, we need to be willing to draw the line and where we're just teasing each other and where we're being absolutely blatantly racist or ignorant in the sense. Like, you know, someone could come up to me and make a joke about me being Hispanic, and I'd laugh about it. You know, it's funny. But if someone comes up to me and says, you know, literally calls me, you know, the B word or something like that, then at that point, it's not funny. Even though they might perceive it as a joke, they might perceive it as funny. It's not. But we need to, it's such a difficult situation. If you get what I'm trying to say here, Bruin, we need to be able to laugh because it shows that we accept ourselves and that we don't struggle with our own identities. But we also need to be able to, as a whole country and as a whole movement, just kind of draw the line and say, hey, this is funny. This is damn racist.
Yeah. You know, I think that in what you're saying, context does matter a lot. You know, the context in which a person says something makes it and it kind of finds the line between it being a racist remark, an insult, or it being a joke. I think that I wanted to bring in two things from my perspective. The first thing is that if somebody insults me or even says something bad about me, if I'm, for example, if they say you suck at basketball, you know, that's, I take it as an insult, but I laugh it off. Because if I laugh it off, I leave that conversation off on a good note. But if I go back and I fight back, I kind of I make that relationship rougher. If it's a good friend of mine, I'm going to laugh it off. I'm not going to continue to take it hard. I think it's, I'm going to say it ain't that deep, bro. You know, yeah, I'm just going to laugh it off. And the other point I wanted to mention is that when somebody makes a remark about race, some of the circumstances, some of the times, I make remarks about Indian, in my own Indian race. You know, I go home and me and my dad and my sister sit down. We are on the dinner table. And we talk about how things are so wrong with Indian employees. You know, his company hires people who don't do the work that they're supposed to do. And it's not a good thing. And we make jokes about that. But I think more than us insulting kind of our culture, it is more so us wanting to improve upon that culture and addressing the flaws of that culture. So in some circumstances, these jokes are just like we're saying before, made to gain progress and clarity about our cultures, especially when it's made by our own culture.
Yeah, well, I think that as a society, we have drawn the line in certain senses on who can say this and who can say that. But it's interesting because, you know, it's like you can say, Vroon, you suck at basketball so many different ways. Now, if me and you were in a 1v1 and I told you, you know, we were messing around, we were just joking, and I say, you know, you suck at basketball, and we're laughing, we're trash talking, then that's one context. But if we're you know, we're rivals or we're this or that, and I'm doing it over a tweet without even using my voice, it's different. It's as if I'm calling you out and saying that you are truly bad. And so it's really the senses in which you and then again, as a friend, you can go and say, hey man, this is wrong, your form is wrong when you're shooting, this is wrong when you're dribbling. And you're kind of taking, are you going to consider that insensitive? Are you going to get offended by someone trying to correct you in the sense that you're going to get offended by someone calling you trash at a 1v1 when you're just messing around? And you're going to take the same offense when someone's literally calling you trash over social media or what be it. So you have to understand, I feel like that's the issue with America. And we need to be able to speak for ourselves, if you get what I'm saying. If someone makes a racist joke, about Hispanics. I appreciate it. I would appreciate if a white person would be like, hey man, don't say that, and stuck up for me. But they have to also understand, in a sense, I can stand up for myself. So we have to be able to see who can't stand up for themselves, and you know, who's the quiet guy that's really being bullied, and stand up for them. And then we need to see, you know, when, at what point are we just gonna let, you know, different people, there's different beliefs within the African American community on who can say the N-word. Some people think no one can say it. Other people think some people can say it. So you have to let people express their own ideology, and you have to understand, hey, if I'm with a gay friend, are they going to get offended if I say this or that? Or hey, if I'm with a white friend and if I make fun of them for being white in this way, are they going to get offended if I say this or that? You have to know who you're talking to and what your audience is, and then go on and make your statements. But if, you know, I talked about it in the Jake Frum thing, if you're having a conversation with one person and then you take that conversation and place it somewhere else, that conversation can be completely out of context.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Lester talked about it in the podcast a lot. You know, he talked about how language is so important in conveying our feelings, conveying empathy, and you know, at the end result, in being a good person. I think language, in the context in which we say jokes and we say things and say remarks, is increasingly important, because as Dr. Lester said, you know, language is perceived in very different ways. I think personally, I look at a person and I judge them based upon how they say things, how articulate they are. And in some circumstances, when a person says derogatory terms on the daily, I definitely look down upon them. You know, even if it's a joke or it's not, it, just them saying that does stand insensitive to me in some circumstances, even though it's meant to be true. I think the line is drawn in one term by context and in another term by what people are using. Because in today's climate and ever, I don't think I've never used the F word, the N word, terms like these. These terms are so derogatory that they should never be used in a circumstance, even if it's as a joke.
Yeah.
You know, and I strongly believe that. I think the line, and you can disagree with me here, but the line is drawn when you use such terms like these, not because of how you're using them, but because of the history of what these terms are. They've been used by other people to discriminate and to simply insult and put down and even kill other people of these ethnicities. So it's the line is drawn by the history of these words.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you know, I talked about kind of in the sense canceling myself because of my previous use of the N-word. And to clarify, again, that wasn't a derogatory use, but it kind of touches back on your point where it's been in a use of historical context, whether it's reading a book or this or that. But, you know, you have to look around in the room. And what I'm trying to say by calling myself out on that, and I've said it, you know, while reading To Kill a Mockingbird, or, you know, you have to out loud in a classroom setting, and you have to wonder, who did I offend? Do you get what I'm saying, Varun? You have to wonder, who did I offend? And that's where the difference has been made. Before, I would have just read it because the teacher was telling me to read it. You know, my white female teacher was telling me, read it. Okay, I'll read it. I'm not, I don't know the context. I don't know the subject matter of this word. I'll just read it. I'm just reading a word out of a book. But to the African-American female that was sitting next to me in that classroom, how did she read that word? How do we read these different words? And how do we move forward and say, hey, I'm going to say this. Let me know if it offends you. And if it does, I'm going to grow as a human and not say it to you next time. Or if it doesn't, I'm going to make the joke and we can have a laugh about it.
Yeah, you know, Dr. Lester talks about an article a long time ago that he wrote about how university students are comfortable saying the N-word because this isn't their history. And I mentioned this in the podcast. Yeah. And so they don't have the same connection as other people do. I think it's a fundamentally flawed argument, and not only in what they're saying, but the fact that they don't understand the history of that term. I think that Dr. Lester's course on the history of the N-word is something that all high schools and colleges should consider. Because it's not just that word that he's delving into, it's the history of American discrimination. And that's something every single person should know more than any other history curriculum. I think we're talking about history, we're talking about the history of the world. World history talks about a bunch of other things that we don't really need to know as much. I think that the thing that we need to understand more than anything is the history of how people have been oppressed in the United States. Because the goal of history, in my perspective, is to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think we should have a whole course dedicated in our high schools and colleges towards the mistakes that we have faced, and not only our triumphs, but our mistakes. Because as Dr. Mason mentioned, as you mentioned so long ago, it's one of our most used quotes on this podcast. History is written, and even Will mentioned this, history is written in the terms of the victors.
Yeah.
The victors write the history books, and that's why we don't see the defeats and the downfalls and the pitfalls of society in our world. Now, it is 4:28. It's almost at the end of our time with the podcast, but I did want to end on letting you speak on your perspective on that issue, and we'll continue with our discussion at the end.
I think that it needs to just be said that we just need to see people. You know, I mentioned To Kill a Mockingbird, and one of the quotes, again, I'm the worst at memorizing things, but speaks along the lines that you never understand a man till you reach into his body and stretch around in his skin and take steps in his actual body and take steps in his actual shoes. That's the only time that you'll ever understand someone. So we need to maybe not change ourselves, and we need to maybe not stop being who we are, but we need to understand how who we are affects other people. And it can be something small as I mentioned, listening to a teacher and saying a word that you don't really understand, that maybe today you understand and yesterday you didn't, but you need to say the next time, hey, I understand this now. I don't think that a big thing with cancel culture is, I don't think that I should have to apologize for something that I didn't know. I think that it shows more character to say, hey, I didn't know this, but I did it. So now next time I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to apologize for something that I didn't know and I did. But I'm not going to do it again, because that'd be worthy of an apology if I knew something and then still continue to do it. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, this was, I think, an absolutely amazing episode, and I think Varun can agree. You need to go out. I think we usually end our podcast on the note. You need to go out and have a conversation and talk about politics and have uncomfortable conversations. But we encourage you after today's episode to go out and look at and examine your privilege and examine things that you've done in the past. You know, it doesn't have to be something extremely racist. It can be something sexist. It can be something this or that. And not criticize yourself, but just understand, hey, you know, how might have this affected someone else? And just think about, you know, your actions, whether it's towards your mother, to your brother, to an African-American friend, to a female friend. It doesn't matter. Just go out and really examine yourself.
Yeah, and adding on to what Damien was saying, I think we should all this weekend and before Wednesday, we should all go out and look at issues that are less focused on in the nation. You know, look at one issue that we haven't talked about on the podcast and kind of bring in that to your own worldview, because I think that it's important that we all look at different perspectives upon our news and our history. Now, I did want to end by saying we have a new website at www.politicinepodcast.com. Let us know what you feel about that website on Twitter or on our email. You know, always follow us on Twitter at Politicine Podcast or Politicine Show. And email us at politicinepodcast@gmail.com. Just a couple of things for next week and the week after. We do have a guest coming in on Wednesday, a very special guest, Representative Brenda Lopez-Romero for the Georgia House of Representatives. She's going to be an awesome guest for us, hopefully, and we'll get to ask her some insightful questions like we did today. This Friday, we're going to have a Pride, gay Pride advocate come on the podcast and talk about his own experiences in coming out and the LGBTQIA community. And most notably, next week, we're going to have Representative Sam Park of the Georgia House of Representatives come out and, again, talk about the issues that we're facing as Americans and answer these uncomfortable questions that Damian and I are talking about and constantly continue to talk about. Now, that said, have a great Monday, and we'll catch you back later this week.
Sure. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for watching today's episode of the Politicine Podcast. As always, make sure to follow us on Twitter at Politicine Show or to, send us an email at politicinepodcast@gmail.com to connect with our initiative. And lastly, as always, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our research director, Julia Hartman, for inspiring the wonderful content that we present day after day, and to our graphic design director and Jada Pilling for the graphics that illuminate our segments. Thank you so much and have a great rest of your days.